There's been almost a mantra about the importance of teams in the workplace, but with so much emphasis on this form of occupational organisation, we thought it was worth a closer look. Are teams always the way to go? How can you tell when a team isn't functioning? And are there times when it's better to announce, let's work like a team and do it my way?
Who better to ask than Richard Hackman, the Edgar Pierce Professor of Social and Organisational Psychology at Harvard University and author of the book Leading Teams. Richard Hackman, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I remember when I was doing some management training in the 1980s, teams were considered pretty hot, and we were told that increasingly in the future, thanks to changes in work and society, they would come to occupy a big role in the way organisations operated. Is that what has actually happened?
There continues to be a lot of optimism about teams. People see what teams are potentially capable of accomplishing, and they get really excited about them. Some have gone so far as to say that they should be the basic building blocks of organizations. And you can see why, because a team compared to an individual has got more resources, it's got diverse opinions, it's got flexibility in how it operates. There's always the chance of, you know, synergy and coming up with something really great. So the upside is really there, and it's very easy to get attracted to that.
I'd like to talk in a moment about some of the things that make teams work or not work, but you've just compared teams with individuals, but what about teams compared with more traditional hierarchies? What are the perceived benefits there?
The nice thing about a team is if you've got a real team where it's say a half dozen of us, and we know who each other are, and we've got a task that's pretty clear and important, and we can work together to try to achieve that and exercise the flexibility that is sometimes needed to do well in a changing environment. If you have a hierarchy, it tends to be a little more structured. Everybody has their individual jobs to do, and sometimes you are unable to take advantage of the special opportunities that you can get when you've got a bunch of people collaborating together.
Hmm.
This is still the upside, you understand. There is a downside.
Sure, no, and we shall get to that. One of the things I remember, I think managing about six people in a very traditional structure. When we'd come back from these courses, you were never entirely sure if you were supposed to be managing them as a sort of team or as a hierarchy. And it seemed to me in my darker moments that if things went well, it's because we were a team, and if they went badly, it was because there was a dud manager there. And my impression looking in from the outside now is that hierarchies themselves have changed a bit, and you'll often come across a unit within a hierarchy, which in a formal sense is, you know, a hierarchy, but it operates more like a team than it would have done 20 years ago. Is that the case? Has the culture of the tradition changed?
I think that's true. We're much less optimistic than we used to be about the efficiency advantages, or should I say the purported efficiency advantages of hierarchies, and we're much less optimistic than we used to be about the purported economies of scale. There's more and more recognition that if you can get a small number of people working together interdependently, really relying on one another for a task that they have collective responsibility for and that's of some importance, that you can really beat larger organizations and hierarchical organizations. So I think that change is occurring. The problem is that a lot of teams are not set up in ways that allow them to take advantage of those real upsides.
Is it possible to generalize about the situations when it is better to have a team, as long as it's a good team, compared with a hierarchy?
I don't know that I can make a generalization about that. I can certainly identify the circumstances when it's better to have a team than an individual, and by the same token, when it's better to have an individual than a team. And I can give you an example of that,
yeah,
if that would be
do.
Helpful. One of the reasons that teams do sometimes get in trouble is that they're given tasks that are not really appropriate for a team. An example I like to use is in music. It takes four people to play one of Mozart's string quartets, so you've got to have a team there. But it was Mozart, not Mozart and Associates, who actually wrote that quartet. When you've got a task like composing a piece of music or writing poetry or crafting a mission statement for an organization where there's a real need for somebody, and I mean a body singular, to put together ideas and images and thoughts and emotions in a totally original way, that's something that is better done by the the solo human mind than by a team. So sometimes teams get into trouble because they're asked to do tasks that are really more suitable for performance by a creative individual.
And does that happen very often? Do you see that quite a bit?
Yes, I do. We've done some work on senior leadership teams, for example, the teams at the very top of an organization. It's a very interesting phenomenon there. More and more organizations are turning to senior teams at the top, so much so that my colleagues, Ruth Wagaman, Jim Burris, and Deb Nunes, and I came to the conclusion that the era of the heroic CEO, the person who's going to take the organization and make it work all by herself or himself, may be past. That these teams, that the demands of the senior leadership of an organization are so great and challenging these days that it takes a team at the top to do it. So once again, we see teams coming in where traditionally there may have been more of a hierarchy. The problem, as I'm getting around to answering the question you asked here, the problem is that one of the things that has to be done is at the top of an organization, we have to decide what our strategy is, what we're really going to try to achieve in this organization. And so very often, you see these teams going off to an executive conference center for the weekend and spending the weekend together, cooped up, stringing subjects and verbs and predicates together, trying to come up with a really exciting mission statement for the organization, and they come back with something that is pretty much lukewarm, something that would have been better done if you really kind of fed one person, perhaps the chief executive, with all the ideas that everybody could come up with, and then sent that chief executive off by herself or himself to try to write what is essentially a piece of poetry. Those are the kinds of things that teams don't do so well.
Now, let's look at the situation where you do need a team, as long as it's a good team. And I know you've written book about this. What are the things that make a good team?
Well, the first thing is it really has to actually be a team. It's amazing, and this is again perhaps part of that optimism that pervades the culture these days. People will say, come join our team, and there's no team there. You may have a hamburger joint, and what you're actually asking somebody to do is to come and flip burgers under the close supervision of the manager, but they think you're going to get these advantages because you call it a team. Well, you don't get advantages just by calling people a team. What you really need to have are a set of people who know who each other are, and that means it needs to be reasonably small so we really can know who each other are, who have diverse talents, skills, perspectives, and experiences, so we got that benefit, and a very clear purpose that we all understand and agree on and that we have to work together to achieve. So that's, we identified in the book Leading Teams, five conditions which need to be in place for a team to have a chance of success, and that is condition number one. If it's going to be a team, it ought to be a real team. And many of the teams we see in organizations these days are teams in name only.
Yeah, I know you've also written about how it needs a compelling sense of direction, but I was struck by the fact that the first impression, often the very first time a team meets, can be incredibly crucial to its future success.
It is hard to overestimate how important the initial meeting of a team is. Just getting the people together and saying, okay, who are we? This is us. What are we here for? What are we trying to achieve? How are we going to go about that? Just getting ourselves established and launched toward that compelling purpose that you mentioned is hugely important. If that's not done, sometimes teams can get off on a bad track from which it's very, very difficult for them to recover.
Yeah. You've even quoted a conductor who says it was literally the first minutes of his meeting a new orchestra that really decide what happens afterwards.
That's right. And this was a wise conductor because he knew that when he walked out on the rehearsal stage, he had a very, very short amount of time to establish what we're going to try to do in making music together. Mm-hmm. We've seen this also in commercial aviation. My colleagues and I have done a number of studies of cockpit crews of civilian and military aircraft, and there's increasing recognition in that industry of the importance of having a really good briefing of the crew before the members go out and sit in their seats and unfold their prescribed roles. Just who are we? What's the special demands and challenges and opportunities of this flight? How are we going to work together? We know who we are. Okay, now let's go to the airplane and settle in and start to get ready to do the work. In fact, let me just go one step further on that, Michael. The National Transportation Safety Board in the United States did a analysis of the accidents and incidents that were in their database. They investigate all the accidents and incidents that occur in the U.S., and they discovered it's about 70% of them occurred on the first leg of the first day of a new crew flying together. And that says the team really has to get itself established and learn how to work together before they're going to be able to operate effectively, or in this case, safely, further reinforcing the importance of the beginning.
Well, that's extraordinary because, as I understand it from, I have a relative who used to fly, that they always chop and change the crews, don't they, anyway? I mean, for every flight almost, they put together a new group.
That's a real problem. It's economically more efficient if we treat each aircraft and each pilot as a separate entity, and then we try to use some algorithm to maximize their joint utilization. But if you're really trying to have the safest flight and the flight with the best service provided by the flight crew, you're going to want to keep the crews together. They call that in the trade having hard crews, so they really learn over time how to work well together.
Can that be taken too far, though? Is there a risk that team members can get too comfortable with each other? And if there is, what do you do about that?
That is a piece of conventional wisdom that everybody, including me, believes until I actually looked at the literature. And there is no evidence, and I've combed the research on this pretty clearly. There's no the conventional wisdom, Michael, is that we're going to get better for a while, and then after a while, we're going to become too accepting of each other's foibles and miscues, too forgiving of each other. We're going to get into petty conflicts, and eventually our performance is going to turn down. And there just isn't any evidence for that. What happens is we get better fast in the early stages of our life together, and then the rate of improvement decreases. It kind of flattens out a little bit, but we continue over time to get better and better, although at a slow rate. We don't see that downturn. Since we've been talking a little bit about music, the Guarnieri String Quartet, for example, members have been together for 45 years. Unbelievable. And they just keep getting better and better and better over time.
But having said that, it's important for teams to stay together and understand each other. That doesn't necessarily mean, does it, that they have to work together in some sort of perfect harmony.
They won't work together in some perfect harmony, and you're really good at identifying the misconceptions that some people have about teams. The fact that we're going to not do so well if we stay together for a long time is one, and the other is that harmony is better than conflict. If we can have real conflict and we know each other well enough to trust that this conflict is about the work, it's not about who likes whom or dislikes whom, but it's conflict about the work, that we can say the things that are hard to say that suggest maybe, hey, we may be heading down the wrong track here. Let's reflect on that. No, we're doing fine. No, we really need to look at where we're going. That kind of conflict turns out to promote creativity. So harmony is not necessarily a good predictor of how well the team is going to do. In fact, we see that harmonious interaction tends to come more as an effect than as a cause. That is, when we've done really well, an athletic team, for example, that has won its league championship, they're going to be really happy and feel really good about it, but that's because they did well in their work. If we take it the other way around and say if we take people off for an off-site ropes course and do all kinds of things to build cohesiveness ahead of time, does that mean that they will then subsequently do really good on their task? And the evidence for that is not necessarily.
Richard, we're almost out of time, and yet I know there is so much more you could tell us about teams, but one final, it's almost an observation from what you have told us. It seems like it's almost an accident if you get a good team together that works well, because the influences and factors you've just described, it would almost be impossible to engineer them, wouldn't it?
It would probably be almost impossible to engineer them, but we're not actually talking about engineering. There's two ways to go wrong in setting up a team. One is to imagine that a great leader will take care of everything, and the reliance on the leader for managing things as they go is a little bit exaggerated. So what the leader wants to do is, or what we would want the leader to do, is to get in place just a handful of conditions. We talked about some of them. There are two or three others, but just the basic conditions, which, when in place, increase the chances that the team is going to do well. And then the leader can help the team take advantage of those conditions. So it's absolutely doable, but it's doable not by trying to run the team in real time as if you were a puppeteer running your puppets, but instead by getting the proper conditions in place and then helping the team take good advantage of them. It's a different way of thinking about team leadership.
Richard, thanks very much for your time today.
It has been a pleasure, sir.
Richard Hackman is the Edgar Pierce Professor of Social and Organizational Psychology at Harvard. His recent book is called Leading Teams, Setting the Stage for Great Performances, and that's published by Harvard Business School Press.
And that's about it for us today, but coming up next week on Counterpoint, questioning collapse. Norman Yoffe, an archaeologist from Michigan University, he critiques popular writer Jared Diamond and the notion that environmental degradation and overpopulation have caused ancient societies to collapse. In one case study, he asks, did the people of Easter Island really commit ecocide?
And we take a good hard look at conspiracy theory. David Aronovich throws cold water on some of the more crazy ideas getting around and asks why they've become such a part of modern life. Are we really that gullible? David Aronovich on conspiracy theories next week on Counterpoint.
But for now, Counterpoint is produced by Ian Coon. Sound engineered to within an inch of his life by John Diamond. I'm Paul Comrie-Thompson.
And I'm Michael Duffy. Coming up next, the Radio National News.